Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, what's wrong with the administrative state? And Richard, one of the perhaps surprises of the Trump administration has been the extent to which it has shined a light on the problems of the administrative state, which is something that heretofore had primarily been an obsession of some legal scholars and some conservative intellectuals. But because the Trump administration has really put it in its crosshairs, this argument is now getting sort of a broader hearing. Now, why don't we start with this? When we talk about the administrative state, we're talking about the expansive powers that are located within government agencies or departments that really have no meaningful democratic controls. In the Trump era, this sometimes gets conflated with what is called the deep state. Those two concepts aren't unrelated, but they're not at all the same thing. Can you tease out the distinctions for us?
Well, I think that the deep state generally refers to those portions of government which are so far removed from public appearance that they can operate in mysterious and therefore nefarious ways. And anybody who is concerned with the legitimacy of the modern administrative state is not concerned with things that are kept so secret that you can't see them. The essential question that they are concerned with is the interaction of the way in which these administrative agencies deal with the promulgation of rules or the decision of individual cases in relationship to the courts who have some kind of oversight against them. And there's no question that there's been an increasingly uneasiness in the Trump administration. And the irony of this starts as follows. One of the key issues that you have to worry about in virtually all of these cases is the extent to which you're going to allow administrators to make adjudications on individual cases involving individual people who are claiming that their patents have been infringed on the one hand or that they've been deprived the license on the other. And you can see what has happened is the Democrats today do not care very much about procedural due process, and the Trump administration does. So there were two cases in the last term that kind of illustrate this. One of these cases was called Oil States, and it involved a situation in which the patent appeals board was asked to decide on the validity of a certain patent which had already been approved through the patent office and had been upheld in federal district court. And so what they did is they claimed under the America Invents Act the power to bring this determination back into the administrative agencies and to trump what went on in the court. And what they did is they had a chief judge named David Ruschke at the time, and he first assigned three people to do this, and it looked as though they were going to uphold the patent, so he put two more people on the panel, and then it's still going to uphold it. Then he put two more people. He may have put himself on it. And so eventually, after three tries, he managed to get this thing invalidated. And the most elementary concerns of due process is you don't pick your judges after you've actually heard the case, and you don't pick them in order to basically advance the particular administrative objective of the chief judge. And what the Trump administration did is they removed him from his position, and they kicked him upstairs after all this stuff came to light. What was so extraordinary about the Supreme Court decision is that this fundamental due process issue was not discussed at all. Rather, what they asked the question as to whether or not this particular issue could be one tried before a panel. And in one of the worst opinions I have ever read, Judge Clarence Thomas, knowing nothing as best I could tell about the subject, said that the resolution of a patent dispute involves a so-called public right, which is analogous to figuring out whether or not customs office have turned off their money back to the state or whether or not land grants have been basically properly issued and so forth like that. He just got it, I think, completely wrong. But the interesting issue was the Trump administration did not like the procedures, and the substance was unimportant. In the other case, there was a situation involving a man named Lucia who had a bunch of promotional devices for selling securities. And the SEC looked at this and decided that he was committing some kind of a fraud when he made a general sales pitch, which he had made forever, and had cleared it through some SEC people and some private oversight regulations. Did is they appointed a man to judge this particular case who had always ruled in favor of the SEC and had always sanctioned people heavily and in many cases had disbarred them. I mean, thrown them out of their own business. They were not lawyers, so they could not be disbarred. And what happened is this is such a terrible way to do things, to pick people on the grounds that somehow or other you know they're going to come out in your way, that interestingly enough, the Trump administration refused to defend the particular result and procedures, so the court had to find some independent lawyer in order to defend that. And Justice Kagan, in a strong but not outstanding opinion, said you can't do this in this particular fashion, and if you send it back again, you're going to have to get yourself another judge to handle this case. But again, she did this under something known as the Appointments Clause, which asks the question of whether or not the president or the head of a department can make some appointment of an inferior officer, but did not hit the due process issues. So many of us who deal with administrative law say you cannot involve a situation where people are going to lose their life, liberty, and property, and do so under a procedure which is rigged in this particular fashion. So even if you decide that the administrative law part of the court should have an adjudicative function, it turns out it just cannot be done by a set of tribunals which have none of the features of independent courts. And when people like Justice Gorsuch and now Judge Kavanaugh make the argument that somehow or other the administrative state has gone too far, what they're really worried about is the use of these kinds of ad hoc tribunals to handle this particular issue. And on this thing, I think they're completely correct.
Where does the administrative state come from? The founding fathers did not come together, presumably, in Philadelphia to create a series of unaccountable regulatory agencies. So what are the major turning points that got us from there to here?
Well, I think the first thing one has to understand is that you cannot run a government without having an administration. And if you start looking at the original Constitution, there was no provision for independent administrative agencies, which were officially sanctioned in 1935, having first been put into effect in the 1880s with the Interstate Commerce Act. But you certainly had departments and heads of departments. And these people have to be able to do something. So the administrative state essentially says, we have to run these various issues. Now, what were the issues that you had to run at that time? Well, they basically fell into three major classes. One is that you have lots of people actually work for the government. Sometimes they're in the military. Sometimes they're in the civil service. They have various kinds of issues that come up over pay, promotion, retirement, and so forth. And the early origins of the administrative state put together a to decide these particular claims. And it was early on held that if there was a consistent practice followed by these agencies through thick and thin, no individual applicant could come to the government and said, redo the entire system for me. And so the notion of deference started in connection with these routine determinations, which were essentially the resolution of contract disputes. And the similar tradition arose in connection with land grants, which was a huge issue at the time because so much of the land of the United States was owned by the government, and they were constantly looking at ways to see whether or not they could sell it or lease it to various private parties. And the third issue that got a huge amount of attention at the time was the administration of the tariff system. And this was kind of complicated because tariffs were an important source of revenue, and you would have to worry about a couple of things. One, whether or not the people who collected the tariffs had turned the money over to the government. And you also sometimes had to worry about the question of how the tariff should be set, given some formula that had been done. And it turns out that the Supreme Court acknowledged that administrative agencies had grown up to have this quasi-judicial function inside of them and essentially legitimated this particular practice, even though it wasn't in Article III courts. But when you get to the Endangered Species Act and you get to most modern environmental statutes, it's much more ambitious. What you're essentially doing is giving the government huge powers to designate lands, for example, as being appropriate or inappropriate habitat, to approve the creation of various kinds of facilities like dams and things of that sort by both government and private agencies. And the administrative state is a much more complicated situation to work with. And it is under these circumstances where you have one-off decisions, exceedingly dangerous to say that an administrator can give the last word on the meaning of a disputed statute. And in the Chevron case, which came down in 1984, the Supreme Court, which I think misunderstood the earlier history, said that if the statute is ambiguous, then we defer to the agency. Even, it turns out, if later on some other court actually makes a judicial determination of what the thing means, and the agency decides afterwards to knock this thing out. That was a case called Brand X in 2005. And so the basic argument about this is if you look at the text of the Administrative Procedure Act, which was passed passed in 1946 in an effort to rationalize the huge expansion in federal authority that took place with the advent of the New Deal. It says that all questions of law shall be decided de novo, which is fancy Latin. You decide what you think to be correct on the merits. And if the government has all the expertise that is claimed for it, when it presents its case, it would be persuasive on its own right, and you don't need the presumption. The moment you start giving the presumption, then the question is, what do you mean by the word ambiguous? And that turns out to be, well, ambiguous. And if you give ambiguity a broad definition, it means that the government runs virtually everything and the courts do very little on this particular situation. And the position that I have always taken is, both as a statutory matter and as a constitutional matter, we know they're going to be hard cases, but if a court can decide them de novo, it does the best they can. And sometimes they may well be wrong, but you do not treat a statutory dispute that arises out of an administrative agency any different than you treat a statutory dispute that arises out of some direct action between two parties in which the administrative state is not involved. And if we can, as we usually can, do better or worse than statutory interpretation in these other cases, we don't want to develop this elaborate body of law which tells us when we defer, how much we defer, why we defer. You want in every case, when you're dealing with a question of law, for the government essentially to argue its piece, but to have the courts ultimately decided on this de novo basis.
Richard, one of the big selling points for the right on Justice Gorsuch, and one of the big ones that's been employed for Brett Kavanaugh as well, is their opposition to Chevron. What do we know about how the more senior justices on the court think about this, and what should we be anticipating in the future in terms of the court dealing with these issues?
This, of course, is one of the great unknowns, but there is no question that there has been, I think, an increased awareness that some of the decisions that have gone on in the name of deference are highly suspect. So to take one justice whose positions don't matter in the future, Justice Scalia decided a case called Auer v. Robbins back in 1997, in which he allowed the Department of Labor to determine who counts as an executive, administrative, or professional employee. And they gave a preposterously broad definition. He said, we're going to defer to it. And, you know, 10 years later or 15 years later, somebody mentions this case to him. And he says, who wrote that strange opinion? To which he was then told that he did. Justice Thomas has also been very deferential in the administrative state, saying if there's any conceivable rationale that justifies the particular interpretation they give forward, we have to accept it. And he has become more uneasy about it. It's generally thought that Justice Alito, being more conservative than the other two, is probably in this camp. And Justice Roberts has kind of waffled one way or another on exactly the way in which this thing starts to work. So what you do is, if you look at this, Justice Thomas seems to have changed his mind some on this. Alito is probably more of a rule of law type. Gorsuch is surely in that quarter. Kavanaugh is likely to be there. So the swing vote is now Justice Roberts. On the other side, the Democrats have been consistently hugely deferential. The leader on this is Justice Breyer, whose opinions I think are almost always wrong, to the extent that he's willing to defer on things that I think have fairly clear meaning. Now, why the division? Well, right now you got a Republican in power, so you'd say, oh, the Democrats should be the one trying to shut down administrative deference. But people are thinking on the long game. And essentially, if you look at the Republicans, rarely do they have an administrative agenda to expand the scope of administrative agency action, whereas the Democrats almost always have that. So let me give you but one example on environmental law. The statute says that the Clean Water Act applies to the waters of the United States, including territorial waters. And the Republicans think that means it applies to the waters of the United States, the rivers, the streams, the lakes, the ocean, seas within territorial boundaries, and so forth. The Democrats think that you can read the word waters of the United States to include all uplands, which eventually may drain into some river. So there was a recent case in which the Army Corps of Engineers, using this definition, asserted the ability to have an exhaustive administrative review of somebody who wanted to dig out some peat from a bog located 120 miles from the nearest navigable river. And, you know, some of us look at the English language and say, this cannot be what's meant at all. response. These guys can dig to their heart content, and the moment it turns out that the government can detect that they're doing something which hurts the river, they can enjoin their behavior. That's not going to happen. If you want to figure out how you monitor it, you could have people inject various kinds of specific dyes and then trace their movement to see whether or not something has made it 120 miles to the sea. But the government doesn't want to do this, and then they require a minute and exhaustive inquiry as to whether or not your land is suitable for this, costing hundreds of thousands of dollars. And in many cases, they won't even tell you conclusively whether or not you are actually within or outside the scope of the statute. They say, you know, we haven't quite decided. You go ahead and you want to risk a penalty, you can risk a penalty. In one case, the penalty that was going to be imposed on somebody who wanted to dig a foundation on dry land located several houses from the water, a case called Sackett, the penalty was $37,500 a day. So when you start looking at this, people clearly want to nip away at the edges on these things about how much aggressive behavior you can have through the administrative agency. I think one has to be much more fundamental about this and to understand that when you're talking about pollution, there are well-established traditional common law rules, and those are the ones that you apply. And yet early on, the moment these rules were announced by Democratic parties under Carter to begin with, everybody said that the traditional rules don't apply. And this constant unwillingness to give people the defendant the benefit of common law safeguards in dealing with the torts of pollution, discharge, and nuisance and so forth has been the source of this enormous kind of agitation. And I frankly think that this is indefensible. You're stopping development on all the wrong sorts of reasons, killing jobs, wiping out landowners, and are doing so on this basis of extravagant interpretation that nobody could defend if you had to do it under a standard of de novo review.
So the final question that I'll put to you, Richard, is Chevron enough? If a future Supreme Court were to overturn that precedent, would we regard the problem as mostly solved, or would we have to move to other fronts to rein in the excesses of the administrative state?
No, it's not going to be solved, although it would certainly make a huge difference. So just to give you some other issues that you have to worry about, who has standing to challenge what's done by an administrative state? There are many documents which makes it very difficult for people to get into court and to say, really, I'm entitled to do this. There is a practice now, for example, to use so-called guidance documents, which are not binding on everybody, but are binding on everybody inside the government. And so what they tell you is this is not binding on you, but by the way, if you decide to go against what we've told you we're going to do, we're going to lower the boom on you. And so it's a kind of an interim attack that you have. And you have this funny rule as to when there's a final administrative order, which is going to be subject into the court. There are lots of complications associated with figuring out when or when not an administrative agency has jurisdiction over a particular kind of case. There are huge problems dealing with what we call arbitrary and capricious review on fact questions. And it turns out essentially the way the cases play out, say, in an area that I'm familiar with on the pipeline stuff, if you want to build the pipeline, you make the slightest error in dealing with hundreds of calculations, you're arbitrary and capricious because you've managed to consider something that the statute does not regard as relevant or ignore something that the statute does revolve as relevant. But on the other hand, if the government says, we're going to block this particular pipeline, they say, well, so long as there's any possible reason for this, why should a court look at this thing with anything other than extreme deference? So what you do is you get very different standards in administrative law on these factual questions. And when you have the anti-environmental forces who are protesting, you really take out the microscope and look at everything. And when it turns out that they've actually granted or refused to grant a permit to build something like this, it's almost impossible to dislodge the administrative decision. And so it's a huge problem that goes far beyond the Chevron rule. And I do think, in effect, that there's a kind of a clear principle that tells you what you ought to do. Administrative agencies aren't magic. The closest analogy is they're like trial courts deciding a particular issue. And that means, in effect, on questions of law, everything is de novo. On questions of fact, where they make a determination, you have to show that it's wrong by some degree of substantial evidence. And you can't use differential standards of arbitrary and capricious to start to deal with it. That goes a long way to deal with this thing. But what one has to realize is that administrative law has to be decided on sort of operative principles of administrative law, and it cannot be decided on the grounds that, oh, we really don't like new development, so we're going to enforce the environmental standards. We think that new drugs are going to be terrible, so we're going to enforce very tough FDA standards and so forth. What you try to do through administrative law is to get an accurate reflection of a constitutional statute, and there are many people, myself included, who think that in too many cases, the law has not been applied in that particular fashion. This is not an argument which says you don't need an EPA or an FDA. It's an argument to say that they must operate within traditional principles and respectable boundaries.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting definingideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.